Well, has science been manipulated by governments throughout history? Up next, the Inside Track with Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Fred Bell, flying saucer contactee, was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, not too far from Detroit. And after high school, he joined the Air Force. He was trained to work on radar and was stationed at a facility where numerous UFO contacts were tracked. Following his time in the Air Force, he worked with Rockwell International and then as a consultant to various companies in the aerospace industry. And it was during this time that he became interested in Eastern spirituality and studied with several spiritual leaders and masters as well. And he obtained a degree in alternative medicine. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Fred, welcome back.
Hey, George, it's great to talk to you again, and I look forward to having lunch with you soon.
It's coming up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty hard lunch to get in. I think it's almost sold out.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah.
It's for a good purpose.
So oh, I know. Like everything you do is great. I'm really proud of what you're doing.
You know, I'm used to you with your work in alternative medicine, an incredible story of your contactee experience as well. Tell me about Inside Track. What happened to you here to get you involved in this?
What happened was this, you know, you just described the last 33 years of my life, and there was a previous 33 because I'm 66 now.
You don't sound it.
I feel really great. And, you know, my government life started with Dr. Donald Katz at Randolph Lab at the University of Michigan when I was 13 years old, and just continued on and on and on and on, you know. So people don't know, you know, that I work for Lockheed, you know, and they don't know so much about me. I put these things up on the internet to, you know, to share with people now, because nobody believed that I had another life for, you know, another 30 years before that. Of course, obviously, 12 or 13 of it was a kid, but I never really had much of a childhood. And because my dad was involved with a lot of stuff, and I guess it sort of just passed on to me. And so what happened was, as I went through, you know, after I got out of the Air Force, at first, you know, it's like, well, I got to go step back.
Also, because you're on with me all night tonight, I think you have to tell us about your father and how that situation occurred and what happened to him.
Okay.
And because that's a lot of who you have become now.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well, to make a long story short, you know, or a short story long, I don't know which. I was born at the University of Michigan 1943, August 10th, and the delivery person was a doctor named Norman Miller, not the artist, but a doctor. And I remember my birth. That was the strange thing. My mother still can't believe there was these two guys in these green, you know, garb that, you know, like these, what do you call them, something, not sweats, but whatever they wear.
Yeah.
And two nurses. And I said to my mother, and I have the birth certificate at home, and I said to my mother, why was there four people delivering me? And she says, well, because Henry Ford Sr.'s physician was delivering you because your dad was, like, you know, in a good place with him. And that's how I sort of got here. And then so my dad had gone, you know, and this is where we'll get into this later, but my dad had gone to the university.
By the way, scrubs, that's what they call it.
Yeah, scrubs, exactly. Sorry. You know, a senior moment here.
You know, it just hit me.
Yeah, I know. You're not as old as I am, I don't think. You look a lot younger. Anyway,
that's why I got it before you did, by seconds.
You know? Yeah, you did. You did. So anyway, my dad went to the University of Michigan at the same time as Clarence Kelly Johnson did. And he, was the Skunk Works pioneer of so much stuff. And so my dad went through school, got two degrees. He got one in electronic engineering and one in mechanical engineering. And then he went on, and then he was working for Henry Ford first, number one, the old man.
The inventor Henry Ford.
Yeah, right. the original Henry Ford. And there's a lot of stories there, but my favorite story is that Henry Ford hated the petroleum industry, had 18 acres of hemp plants, and had 14 automobiles running on, you know, hemp derivatives, mostly ethanol. And him and Rudolf Diesel had some kind of relationship, who also designed the diesel engine. So that's kind of where that started. So anyway, my dad got out of school, went to work for Henry, went over to Henry Ford. He invented the alternator and the automatic transmission partially, you know, and then he went on to work with Bendix, And then he came out here to California, and my mother wouldn't move out here, so he came alone. And he met Robert McCulloch, and McCulloch and him became great friends. And Robert McCulloch, at that time, in like 46 or so, he owned all the land that became LAX and up there. And back in that Hilton Hotel that we're going to do our seminar in was actually part of my dad's laboratory, that whole side of Century
You're
Boulevard.
Kidding. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Remember McCulloch?
Yeah.
That was my dad McCulloch and C.B. Woods. And so then they went on. They did a Site 6 in Arizona, Lake Havasu. My dad went to England and brought the London Bridge over and put it in. And my dad always thought I was crazy because I was more of the New Age guy. Although Bob McCulloch and I had a manufacturing company together to make transistors for power supplies and computers back in the day, and that was back in the 70s. That was some of the stuff that I did. So, that's sort of where I fit in with my dad, and he got me into McCulloch. But after I left Rockwell and NASA, I hooked up with Jim Sachs at Virtus Instruments, and from there I visited all these companies. Kind of like blindsided because I didn't know the CIA was here and the CIA. When I was hanging out with a guy named Bud Whelan, who took over from Bissell, who was the CIA commissioner that blew the exploding cigar in Castro's face, I didn't know that Bud Whelan, who when I knew him was the vice president of Hughes Aircraft and was sharing all this stuff with me, was former CIA. So I was like blind.
Ah.
Yeah, I was blind through this whole experience that I was going through of these companies. And why was I popular? Because I was a metrologist. A metrologist was a person that does instrumentation. And so I was very good. I'm not trying to brag, but I was very good at what I did. And the funny thing about it was I wore a Confederate war jacket. Now, I did have pictures of this in all these companies. And of course, I sold, oscilloscopes and power supplies and transducers, all these kinds of things to these different companies. And in the process, the big thing in those days was you keep a low profile. Well, I didn't believe in that. You don't drive up and take some guy out to lunch in a Chevy. I bought a Lincoln Continental and did it that way.
And showed up in a Confederate war outfit.
Confederate war jacket. And I've got, if I get a chance, I'll show them to you sometime. There was a magazine, in those days there were, there were rags, like Electronic News was the big rag in those days in the 60s and 70s. And Electronic News covered everything from what Lockheed was doing to Rockwell to everything. It was just the newspaper, and I was always in it, and I got tons of articles where they followed me around because I was this wild and crazy guy. I didn't know any better, but I knew my craft, and my craft was that I needed, if you had a spaceship or you had a car or you had anything and you need to if it's an aircraft you need to measure stress in a wind tunnel, I'm your man with a strain gauge.
All right,
the whole thing.
So you were the man.
I was the man.
At that age, were you beginning to experience this I guess we could call it the one world order? But
no, absolutely not. That's the funny part. I absolutely experienced nothing. I was, I guess I'm pretty much, in being a Leo, I probably still have too much ego even now, but even then I was worse, because I'm aware of it now. Then I wasn't. I'm serious. I was terrible. All I cared about was getting in, taking over, and getting out, and I went to all these companies, and I've got logs and logs of them, and a lot of the companies I even posted on the internet at various places to show people with my handwriting and the names and all these guys, but that's what I did. I was at IBM. In East Fishkill, or I'd be one time I gave a lecture in Amarillo, Texas, for the Atomic Energy Commission when I was working for a company called AMC with an oscilloscope, and this was a sampling oscilloscope at that time that would go to 1 gigahertz, which was quite fast. And they wanted to monitor hydrogen bombs, warheads. So I'm down in a bunker underground and sitting there with an AMC device. They were up in Los Gatos, California. I was the vice president of the company at the time, and I'm sitting there with a broken one. And they sold for $12,500, and I got a broken one there, and I got a blackboard, and I'm sticking these probes on a hydrogen bomb, and I'm saying, this is the waveform you should see, and this is the waveform you will see if this thing worked. And guess what? They bought a 10 of them, which was a $250,000 order, you know. But
they bought 10 of them even though the one you had was broken?
I swear to God.
That's amazing.
And the president, if anybody ever wants to Google him, it was Sam McCutcheon. He was the president of the company.
Yeah, those things don't happen today, Fred.
No,
yeah.
I know. It's a little bit different. I agree.
So when did you begin to realize that science is being manipulated by governments, by companies?
Well, the first awareness I had of it, but I put it aside, was when I was in the Air Force. It's the 776th Aero Squadron in Point Arena, because I realized they were destroying these DDS Form 332s, which were the UFO reports that my scope operators had, PPI, plan, position, indicator, operators had to run. So they would destroy those after these guys would fill them out. Excuse me. So that didn't make much sense. So that was the beginning of it. But when I started to realize it, it's probably when I got over to Autonetics. Well, actually, probably not even then, when we were working on the eyelash. That's a good question. I'm not quite sure when I woke up. But I started. Oh, I know when it was. When I was down at Seal Beach working with Wernher von Braun and the Saturn, we were building the second stage of the Saturn rocket. And I started having these. I realized I wasn't a contactee. I never even thought of this stuff in those days, but I knew about the Roswell incident. You know, the Roswell incident.
You heard about it, or did someone?
I knew about it. I knew about it, and I was working with another engineer. His name was Clay Davis Jr. And you know, we were just junior engineers at that time. And I told Clay, I said, Clay, you know, I think, you know, from what I've heard about Roswell and aliens and stuff, I realize I'm only coming from a you know, intellectual point of view, with something down inside of me that hadn't woke up yet. And I told Clay, I said, you know, I think there was this crash up in Roswell where these alien bodies were. And Clay just thought I was stupid. So he went home and told his dad about it. Well, it turns out his dad was a senior vice president of SNID at one point, a Space and Information Divisions of Rockwell.
And he probably knew everything.
He did. He was one of the, I forget how many scientists that was there that went out and examined the bodies. And then when Clay Jr. Came back, and he had a white face the next day, and he says, you know what? You know, I thought you were nuts, but your dad says you're real. You know, then I started to wake up with that kind of stuff, you know.
And he probably knew more than most about what happened at Roswell.
Oh, yeah, he knew a lot more than I did. But it really happened. I mean, this is how little bits and pieces of my life started to fall together. And the other side of the coin was really interesting. The way we worked at Rockwell is that we reported in, this is at Seal Beach where we built the Saturn II, and I'd already worked for Scott Crossfield previous to that, who flew the X-15, and that's when I worked on the Apollo program, but that wasn't very exciting. This was the Saturn, and that was later. So
Apollo was not exciting for you?
Yeah, it was exciting. I used to sit in it at night and switch the switches because my job was to make sure little circuits worked. You know, it was kind of a stupid job, but I mean, it was important. But yeah, I liked it. But the Saturn is where it was at. It was just a whole other deal because Wernher von Braun came strutting in. You know,
well, he was the king, wasn't he?
He was the king. Yeah, and he, you know, he had brought over from Germany on Operation Paperclip, which I know you and your listeners know about, or our listeners or whatever, a guy named von Lossberg. And so what would happen is we would check in. Rockwell would pay our wages, and then we would check in to the NASA group, and it was like homeroom in the morning. And then this von Lossberg guy, who was Wernher von Braun's right-hand man, wearing, you know, ski, you know, nylon ski clothes, ski boots, and these helmets. They were painted gold. We had to wear these gold helmets. And we had to look gung-ho and smart and thin, and that's what we had to do. So we'd sign in there, and then we'd go to work for NASA. At the end of the day, we'd unclock from NASA and go back to Rockwell. That's how it was structured in those days. It was kind of weird. And so I had the Third Reich sitting over me on top of it, I felt, the way these guys were. They were not very friendly people.
And some say, Fred, that the Third Reich is still around. Somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you get into Tavistock and some of this other stuff, it's still around. Yeah, IG Farben, all of that. Yeah, it's still around. But I mean, this was the beginning of my life. This is before I went out to the electronics companies and did all that. this is what I was going through, and I'm like only 20 years old, you know, so I don't know what. You know, I'm just this kid that's kind of gone up through the science community and done something to become a, you know, a junior engineer and later a, you know, senior engineer, but I'm just wet behind the ears. I don't know what's going on, but I'm starting to get a, you know, a sense that something is bigger. And so finally, I'll never forget this, two big incidents happened in Seal Beach. One was a few months prior to that, they were doing tests on loading the fake, you know, the fuel tanks. They were filling them up with water and then pressurizing them on a big tower, and the pressure was to to duplicate acceleration, and the Saturn broke and it flooded Seal Beach with all these millions of gallons of water.
Oh jeez.
Yeah, that was the first incident, and the second incident was the night that we brought out it was in this big tall building. You know, if you ever go to Long Beach or Seal Beach, you'll see this big tall building with a crane on it, still there. We brought the bird out, you know, and we were taking pictures of it. The press was there. First time the public had ever seen it, and a flying saucer came by, a disc came by. And that then I knew something was really going on.
Did everybody see it or just a few
people? Oh, yeah, 453 people, to be exact, saw it. 453 people. I wish that the date had to be around early 66, like in the early winter hours. I mean, January, February of 66.
What did it look like?
Well, it was a big disc. You know, it was like
the typical disc, I guess.
Yeah, but it was big. It was probably 40 feet, hovered, and then left. It wasn't there very long, but 453 people saw it, including Clay Davis. And I was getting, I had become a believer in flying saucers. I wasn't a contactee or anything. Had no idea about that. And I was, becoming kind of like the nutcase around there, you know, like probably I'm considered now out there. You know, it's what goes with my reputation. But bottom line was when that came, you know, once again, they where's this Fred Bell coming from kind of thing, you know?
It was probably on a surveillance mission, no doubt, huh?
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah.
Fred, in one of your chapters of your work, The Inside Track, you talk about the emergence of evil in our societies. You know,
yeah.
I happen to think it's been around for a long time.
Well, I do. I agree with you.
And tell me, in terms of how you noticed this, that you would devote a chapter to that.
Well, you know, explain something here. Emergence of evil. I've studied a lot of history. I became a history major at one point in my time. So when fascism comes up, you know, as it does, you know, there's going to be an attack on the banking systems, as it's been now. There's going to be, like Hitler did, the fatherhood. Now we have Homeland Security, you know, the attack on, you know, the false flag stuff. Okay, then you're going to have an attack on the educational system. There was a big thing on CNN today. They're passing kids through high school now with a 25%, you know, grade level, which would be a F- in my time. Then they're attacking they're creating huge amounts of depression, which people are so depressed, and they're attacking the school children with these drugs. And then on top of that, we have, you know, an overall societal moral decrease in values. And on top of that, one more thing is the satellite, you know, manipulation that's occurring, you know, with our satellite systems, which I helped build, unfortunately, but didn't know at the time. So you see this big multi-pronged attack coming on to our society, and it becomes pretty obvious now. And that's what I was writing about in that chapter.
All right, we're going to take this quick break, Fred. We'll come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Fred's website, by the way, is linked up at Coast to Coast. It's called Paradyne, PYRADYNE.com. Fred Bell with us tonight. Fred, we have seen this debacle on the swine flu where, you know, they screamed it was a pandemic. 14,000 people worldwide sadly have died, but 500,000 worldwide generally will die from the seasonal flu. They've got vaccines stockpiled. Most of them are going to expire. They're not any good, yet they have made billions on these vaccines. Are the drug companies part of what you call this evil group? This
right.
Emergence?
You know, to start with, you know, the drug companies to me started with IG Farben. I'm sure you're familiar with them.
Yes, German-based, right?
German-based, funded by Lawrence Rockefeller before World War II and a couple of big banks in New York City. They went on, and during the, you know, Joseph Mengele and all these kinds of people that were involved, they went on, they made a deal, you know, during World War II for pay out, you know, for research projects, a certain amount of money for kids, a certain amount of money for adults. Then what happened at the end of World War II, you know, for research, and this is where the mind control started. At the end of World War II, what happened was that six of the they were on the dock at Nuremberg. Six of the major players were indicted, but nothing was came of their serious sentencing. And the company broke up into Merck and all the different companies that we know today. That was the beginning of it all.
Was Bayer part of that too?
Yeah. Who?
Bayer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then as after that, they came over here and they started Merck and they started doing. There was two things at this point that there was a split. There was a psychological split where they started doing the Tavistock company had been formed earlier, and we can talk about that in a minute. But it controlled all the intelligence brain, you know, genesis of all the intelligence company, like the OSS, which became the CIA. And so then they went off and did these mind control experiments, which we can talk about in a minute. But that's kind of how it all started. But the big thing was drugs, you know, and Bayer was involved in that too, the Bayer aspirin people. And the Bayer company, before they were making, you know, they were making aspirin, was also involved in making a lot of chemical warfare, as well as Merck, M-E-R-K, which, you know, is one of the producers of the Tamiflu today. So at the end of World War II, all these companies broke up. But Lawrence, the Rockefeller family, was a big financier, along with Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, of the beginning of these companies. And believe it or not, if you look into the history of a lot of these big drug companies, you'll see a lot of indictments and lawsuits. And it's just amazing how corrupt they really are. And when you start... We start getting into the drugs, like when you realize what effects there is and all these different drugs, because I spent years doing the schoolyard shootings and interviewing people, you start to realize that's one of those five things that I mentioned earlier. You can start to see how it unravels into our society, and it's affecting all of the people out there now. Any kind of a drug that you put, a prescription drug you put on your kids, is going to cause a problem, because you can't, you know, there's MOA inhibitors, and then there's... SSRI drugs, and either one of them, when the kids come off of that, they're going to have tremendous side effects, which is also one of them considered homicidal ideation.
Sure, and probably one of the biggest problems, Fred, is get your kid off sugar.
Exactly. Yeah. I have a girl that works for me now that had a child who comes up here, sweet as heck, and just buzzes all over the place. And I said, take this child off of sugar, and he won't buzz all over the place. She didn't believe me at first, but she finally took him off of sugar, and guess what? He doesn't buzz all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I happen to believe that, you know, modern medicine tries to do a wonderful job. You know, there's a lot of great doctors out there that are trying to do the job to help people, take care of them. And I think there are probably some drugs out there, blood pressure pills and things, that have helped a lot of people. But generally... I just think Big Pharma's out to make a lot of money.
Well, they're out to make a lot of money for the stockholders, and you and I, and I'm sure the audience knows the big, you know, cartel between the pharmacist, the doctor, and the drug company. But there, I mean, there's a lot of conscientious doctors out there. But I've known psychiatrists, and I know a couple of them. I think one of them's been on your show. You know, the drug companies approach him if they're not prescribing enough stuff and say, hey, you got to sell some of our stuff.
Yeah, they have a huge marketing program.
Yeah, they do, and you better play games with them, and you better play ball with them.
I mean, I think the American Medical Association is beginning to crack down on the relationship between Big Pharma and doctors, but it's out there.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at Donald Rumsfeld, you know, and, you know, he was twice Secretary of Defense, came in on the Ford administration, you know, he was trying to, you know, push aspartame, which is no good. And it kills. In my work, I've taken people off of it, and they couldn't believe how much better they felt. They were hooked on it. I says, you got to get off this stuff. You won't be depressed anymore. You can function again. It's not that. I says, just try it for a week. Try it for a week. They come off, you know. And look at all the money that he's making on the Tamiflu stuff now. He made, he has 5 million shares of Gilead Corporation. And, you know, in 76, he tried to make the big Tamiflu push, but we weren't buying it, you know. So then last summer he made the big push again, and this time he made himself $45 million. I mean, that's kind of what, to me, motivates a lot of these guys.
Let's talk a little bit about the swine flu and how this all happened. How could, in your opinion, the World Health Organization come out when we just had a few hundred cases worldwide and not a lot of people had even died and say this is going to be a pandemic, which it never was? But how could they say that?
Well, they say it because, you know, they're guided, you know, they're guided by the Tavistock company, was formed in England back in about 1921 to be exact, and they control like Rand and all these companies, and the World Health Organization is one of their many tentacles that, you know, that plans this thing. And if you don't, you know, I mean, I know for a fact, if you were sitting back up there like a Bilderberger, you know, like the big group there, and you're planning these things where you have these meetings once a year, the most powerful people in the world, you look at the drug companies and you look at what you're going to plan. This was a plan. Fortunately, it's backfiring on them, and I knew it would. I mean, you know, they built these 800 prisons, supposedly declared martial law if you didn't do the Tamiflu vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, nobody wanted it. And then when you start looking at the ingredients of what's in Tamiflu, you start to see the same ingredients that are in Effexor, you know, and several of the other drugs that are out there. There's a couple of key ingredients that basically put your brain into a coma and regress you back in consciousness and turn you into an animal. And that's always been observed when these kids, like up there at Columbine, when Dylan Klebo and Eric Harris were shooting everybody, it was because they were coming off of their prescription drugs. They didn't do it while they were on them. They did it because they were coming off of them. And this is well known, because in those drugs, there's two ingredients that they use in most of them. One of them is called piperidine, and the other one is called cyclohexane or cyclohexene. Together, those two make a drug called phencyclidine or angel dust. You know, so, I mean, you're basically drugging these people in one way or another with these SSRI inhibitors.
Well, what are they trying to do, Fred? Control the mind or make money or both?
No, they're both. You know, first of all, we want to go to the big picture. The big picture is they want to eliminate 80% of the population of this planet, and they're doing it by poisoning the foods and blah, blah, blah. But to do that, they want to make lots of money. So they do that through the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry is one of the most powerful industries today. And they lie every step of the way. They say, well, the high price of drugs is because we have research. You know, our research costs all this and our testing. Well, guess what? The universities do all the – first of all, the universities invent the things, and then they sell them to the drugs and get a 14% royalty in most cases. Secondly, a drug company cannot morally run its own tests on its own product.
But we know they do. They find research groups and they fund it.
Yeah,
and lo and behold, the research shows that the drug's okay.
The drug's okay, and that even happened, you know, even with Asperity. Of course, Rumsfeld bought off the FDA, put his own commissioner in there.
Yeah,
yeah,
you
know the story. The FDA still said no, and he says, "Oh, this stuff won't hurt you." You know.
Now there's a product out called AminoSuite, which is still being used by aspartame. They've just changed the name a little bit.
Yeah,
same stuff.
Brand switching.
So if somebody looks at a label, they see the name, AminoSuite, they don't think of aspartame.
No, absolutely not. But any of these things, the bottom line is lay off sugar, you know, and then you won't have a problem, because it depletes so many different, amino acids in the body that make the hormones to produce euphoria. It's kind of sad, you know.
Well, absolutely not. But, you know, the pharmaceuticals, that's not the only area of control. We see it in everything now.
Oh, everything, yeah.
Banking. Sometimes I wonder, maybe it's easier just to go back and be an abductee, be a contact, and not worry about all that other stuff. Do you?
Well, you know, after I became a contactee for a long time, I realized that maybe that's what I came here to do, is to make, you know, to get involved and get in trouble and become a rogue or whatever I am. But, you know, it was, I'll tell you what motivates me is our younger generation, you know, these little kids, they don't have a chance today. I mean, you and I were born in a generation where we had a chance to, you know, experience, you know, somewhat clean air. You know, I was born during World War II, and I guess you were a little after that.
But, yeah.
But the bottom line is the environment was better. We didn't have, global warming. We had a lot more oxygen in the air. We didn't have 15% radioactive water that we have today. We didn't have EL everywhere. We didn't have satellite frequencies and all the stuff that is going into our systems and the spy stuff and the terrorism. We didn't have any of that. So I'd like to see this go back to the point where our children can actually have a life here in this world and becomes like a sacred planet again and not a convoluted, free-for-all, which it's becoming now. And the other thing is, I might bring up there in part of this thing, one of the things is called Project Bluebeam, which I know you're familiar with, mm-hmm. is removing religion, taking God out of the classroom, and you know,
and they're doing that.
Yeah, they're doing it, and it's really sad because everybody can believe in God, whatever that God is to them. It doesn't mean that you're in the classroom, doing the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag under one God, that it's the same God. Everybody has their own interpretation of that. But they're taking away the freedom of the child to experience their own little meditative component of what they would consider God to be. I know when I said the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, I had some version of what God was. And they're taking that away, and that's sad.
Remember that classic Red Skelton speech where he talks about the pledge? And he was so right, because he said when they take God out of the pledge, that's it for us.
That's right. I mean, that's what brought us here from England. That's what set up a country that we have. We made a lot of mistakes. We learned from them. And here we are, you know, a 360, and it's just a spiral in the same direction. But I think people will wake up. There are good things happening, and I think God will come into the equation at some level. Even an atheist, I believe, and I'm not an atheist, but even an atheist is a probably more of a realist. I know internally their belief in not believing in God is their belief system. And so their God would be a not believing in a God. You know, that would be their belief, because people have beliefs. That's the core of our foundation of sanity, I would say, you know, from my point of view anyway.
Have you noticed, though, that during this era, they have positioned it where people can no longer communicate with each other. They can't dialogue with each other. They can't talk things through anymore. Now it's all argumentative. It's all fighting. It's bitterness.
Yeah.
We've lost something here, Fred.
Yeah. I mean, you look back at the 50s and 60s and versus now, there is a lot of confrontation in all these reality shows that are, you know, they're just looking for the discomfort, you know. The media is capitalizing on the discomfort of a spiritual confrontation, if you'd call it that, in all these different reality shows.
Give me your overall perspective on just how you things are going right now, where you think this one world group fits in, and how far they've gone.
Well, I think you know from an industrial standpoint, having worked you know been in RAND and all these different companies and seen what they're doing, there's an internal breakdown going on, and I've seen it a lot. And you know, I still have contact with a lot of different people in these different groups, but I see a breakdown occurring, in which the families in the one world order, their families are becoming dysfunctional. So so I feel that this one world order is becoming visible in a fishbowl, whereas you know people think they're in the fishbowl. They're really not. So I think that because of the breakdown of the family values within the bad guys, if you want to call them that, that's when the justice will start to come. It won't come from the outside. You can never fight these people one-to-one in hand-to-hand combat. That's not going to happen. But you can let, you know, by believing and meditating and believing and praying and, you know, all of, you know, exercise and yoga, whatever it takes to clear your mind, to get a clear spot. And then with the onset of the entanglement process and the people starting to understand the holographic process of life, when that starts to connect, that's going to totally short-circuit these early barbaric Piscean, not against Pisces, it's just a term, Piscean actions that have occurred for the last 2,000 years. It's all coming to an end, and consciousness is going to be the prevalent thing. People are starting to seek that out, and if they don't seek it out, they won't exist.
Tell me your thoughts on the CIA and the MK Ultra projects. What's going on there?
Well, you know, you want a history of them, or do you already have all that, or what?
No, give me a little history of it first.
Okay. I got involved with the CIA accidentally back in when I was at the University of Michigan as a kid with Stephen Eberbaugh. Stephen Eberbaugh was still around. We were still working together. He ended up going off to MIT, and I went off to the Air Force and NASA. And we had developed in the 50s, as kids at the University of Michigan, these neuro brain scanners, you know, that would scan your brain. And we built our own oscilloscope. And I studied a guy named Bridey Murphy, who was my idol at the time. I'm sure you know who he is, the hypnotist.
Sure.
And we would put each other in hypnotic trances as much as we get, and we'd monitor ourselves. And so that somehow or other filtered over, and they ended up with that equipment, and that became, you know, some of the stuff that was in the early days of MK Ultra. Then, as MK Ultra began to progress, you know, in the very, very beginning, they developed more and more machines. First of all, it went to, you know, drugs and mind control. It was like Delgado and those people. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not.
It was like a playbook they had.
Yeah, they had a playbook, and so it developed more and more. They had 149 sub projects. And each one, they ran houses of prostitution funded on different sub-projects.
Amazing.
Yeah, in these houses of prostitution, they would drug people on LSD, abduct them, and then use them for mind control experiments. At the same time, over at Fort Dix, you know, where a lot of this stuff comes from, which is the largest federal, correctional facility for experimenting, people are experimenting with mind control drugs. And this was the big thing with Tavistock. Was the mind control drug stuff, which started back in the 20s, but it didn't really get its impetus until about the 50s. Once it got going in the 50s, then it turned into something a lot more stronger. Then this guy, Delgado, came along and a couple other guys, and they started putting probes in animals. And when they put probes in animals, they started, first of all, connecting them with electrodes. And I actually, In some of my visits to these companies, actually witnessed some of this.
Now, what were they doing with the animals?
They were controlling. Monkeys were their favorite. They were putting probes into the different parts of their brains and controlling, first of all, responses, you know, movement of fingers.
Ah, okay.
You follow me?
Yep.
And then after that, they started, they got a little bit crazier with it, and they started doing it with remote control. And with remote control, they could control it from a distance. And then, then the next thing that came along was, remote control microwave stuff. And so they started using microwave frequencies and those kinds of things. And that started to filter into the satellite programs, but not too much at first. So by the time the 60s came along, they had this down to quite a science. I mean, a big time science.
Well, you can only imagine what they're doing now, Fred. Let's have you update us on that when we come back. Plus, we still... got some time for phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Fred, does any of this frighten you or scare you to the point where you're concerned about the, if not your own safety, the safety of the planet?
Well, it doesn't frighten me for some reason because, you know, fear is a form of ignorance, and I pretty much understand what's going on, you know, now. Not all of it, but a lot more than we could ever do on this show. I want to read you something real quick out of my book here, just something to go to your question that was before the break, okay?
All right.
This have you ever, on your show, have anybody ever mentioned a general by the name of John P. Jumper?
I have not heard that name.
Okay.
I don't think.
This is what this book is about. I tried to do things that weren't on the Internet, okay? In 1998, a news item stated that General John, pardon me for quoting out of my book, but I just had to do this to keep it right. In 1998, a news item stated that General John P. Jumper predicts that the military will have the tools to make potential enemies see, hear, and believe things that do not exist. And the same idea was contained in a 15-volume study at the United States Air Force Scientific Advisory Board in 1996 on how to maintain U.S. air and space superiority on the battlefields of the 21st century. Born in Paris, Texas, he originally joined the Air Force in June of 66 after graduating from the Virginia Military Institute with a degree in electrical engineering in Lexington, Virginia. While in the employ of the United States Air Force, he spent time at Royal Air Force in Bentwaters, hello, UFO thing there, a site of many UFO incidents, Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, and he also worked at Area 51 in control of reverse engineering. This guy is one of the, this guy was trying to tell us something, and he's the real deal, and you can Google him or whatever. And then from that, there's different companies that I came in contact with in my research for the last 4 years on actually, because you asked me before the break, what is going on, where are we at today, okay? And I will continue with that. First of all, there's through the wall surveillance methods. And there's a thing called the cops are going to be having it soon. It's called the radar flashlight. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
Okay, the radar flashlight checks electromagnetic activity of speech controls in the vocal cords. In other words, when we read or think about something, we subconsciously move our vocal muscles.
All right. Is it like a truth detector, Fred?
Well, it's not a truth detector. It's part of the mining process that they're doing on certain individuals to get into the big echelon computers. Because remember, the human brain works at about 500 kilobytes a second. I'm not sorry, 5,000 bits per second.
I should have caught that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sorry. And this is one thing. And then they have other things that they do. There's a company called Silent Sounds. They received a patent number 5,159,703 for using superconductors to analyze human emotional EEG patterns. That's electroencephalograph patterns. Replicate, store these emotion. They call them emotion signature clusters on another computer, and at will, slightly inducing change to the emotional state of the human being.
Amazing.
Yeah. Now this is done through satellite, through what's called the keyhole satellites. The first one went up in 1979 on the STS-38 when they started putting this stuff up in space. And then there's another one. You know what Tetra is? You've heard of that one?
Sure.
You know what Tetra is?
Yeah.
Okay. Just so the people that don't know, that's something that there's 30,000 transmitters, and they put them in subways in London and New York. And guess what? When they first put those in, remember all the subway incidents that were there, all the negative things that happened. So that's another one. And there's several different there's another thing called millimeter wave scanning, where a microwave signal just below the infrared frequency of the region is used. And this is where they do the thought reading, which you're talking about.
How many people would believe this, Fred?
Well, if
I mean, you know, you do, I do, because we know what's going on the inside. But how many people on the outside are listening to you going, come on, Fred?
Well, they've been doing that, George, for 30 all my life, you know. But eventually, you know, I'm not locked up. I'm not in a straitjacket yet. And people still read my books. This is my first mainstream book. And there's not a whole lot of them out there, but they're starting to come out. You know how much controversy this book has stirred up?
Already, huh?
Oh my God! Yeah, it's really stirred the.
By the way, did you only publish 1,000, or is that just the special edition?
I published 1,000 of them for people maybe at Coast and just my own readers. There's two or three major publishers that are looking at this book right now.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, I just put this out there. I didn't realize I'd created a cauldron from hell.
You always do.
Yeah, I didn't know that. My other books, like when I wrote The Rays of Truth and Death of Ignorance, those were about things that I learned and, you know, basic physics and science and stuff like that. This is not about that. This is about what's going on. And in this book, I've got websites to everything that I've mentioned tonight. There's a website to go to, Tavistock, all these things. There's plenty. I want somebody to tell me, hey, Dr. Bell, on page 322, you're full of crap, because they won't. It's not going to happen. You know, this book is really... You know, this is the real deal. And for example, in the way this stuff works now with these new satellites, and you can be sitting there meditating, And if they have their signature, now what they do with the process of this, the it starts with a person of interest, a POI. You know, it's
give me an example.
Okay, a person that's on the internet, and I've seen one guy get executed behind this, a young guy, who goes into the internet, starts researching information, maybe on terrorism or you know, something. They then become, you know, and then they do their emails, and of course Echelon, which everybody knows about, I'm sure by now, tweaks on them. Okay, then what happens is the local guys come out. I've seen this happen. The local guys come out with their little radar flashlights and their little devices on their little cars and trucks, and they get a reading on that person. Then that, then what happens is that is down, that's downloaded into another computer, and then they go up to the satellite. When it gets up to the satellite, they start watching and monitoring that person. Obviously, they're already doing their internet and their telephone, but now they want to see what they do. And that satellite stuff is so, so cool. And I could go into the technology of that, but I don't know if we have time for that. But basically, let's say that person is in downtown New York City at Macy's, all right? And there are a lot of people in there, okay? From a satellite, they could get a person, that person's emotional, you know, blueprint. It's like a fingerprint. They could they know that person's in Macy's. They don't see them in Macy's, but when they come out of Macy's and start walking down Fifth Avenue or something, they can see them. They can now, they found that person. They found them in 10,000. They've sorted that one person out, and now they can follow them down the street.
Amazing.
Yeah. Then they put the cameras on. You know, the cameras on every corner. That's how, that's how accurate it is right now. So you can't be afraid of it. You know, you just got to live in you got, whatever you're going to do, you got to do it in wide open. You know, in front of everybody. That's just how it goes.
Technology has done this to us, though, Fred, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. It really has.
And
it,
it's a, but on the, it's a double-edged sword, and let me tell you why.
On, yeah.
On one hand, we know that there are terrorists out there who hate our guts.
Well,
whether,
that's right.
Whether it's because of our policies or whatever, they hate our guts. And, you know, I'm convinced we haven't seen the end of them on the continental United States.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
On one hand, one would say having this kind of technology to snoop and spy and discover is probably pretty smart to save a nation from the horrible thing that happened in 2001. All right?
I totally agree with that, and I understand that. And there's just certain groups that can misuse the knowledge.
Well, that's where my however comes in.
Yeah, exactly. That's where we need to, as citizens, get our due diligence up, become aware of how, these agencies and how to work a check and balance. And we can do that as citizens, but we got to take an interest.
I mean, you know that if there's a camera out there, if you do your speed limit and if you stop at the red light and then you take off when it's green, you're not going to get your ticket. You don't have to worry about that. But on the other hand, it is an incredible invasion of privacy. So, you know, you, we go back to the founding fathers. What's right? Should, are we giving up our rights and our privacies for all these other issues? And is that right or is that wrong? And that's the tough question.
Well, I think I can sort of answer that in sort of a funny way. In when you walk in, you know, when you walk into a, when you're in your house and a phone rings, you oftentimes know who it is, or in the case of remote viewing, these guys are well trained. They do a pretty good job of it. Or you can go into a double blind study and you can sit two people together, and then you can take and have them meditate, and then you can take one of those people and put them in another room and traumatize the other one, and the other person with the monitoring equipment will be traumatized because they sat next to that person. That's quantum entanglement. What's happening now is in our spiritual growth, we are becoming of one mind. We are entangling. You know, for example, between the two of us, and maybe Tom back there and a couple people that you know, we can probably reach anybody in the world within a few weeks. We're a couple of degrees of separation apart. Because that's the energy that we're coming into now, and that energy will not, you know, the entangling energy, yes, it can entangle with the wrong things, but I feel that there's a high level of goodness that's here that will unentangle these negative forces, and they're going to, a lot of them are going to self-destruct and reach their own demise. You know, just like the two guys that tried to blow things up on the airplane recently, that rich kid that was coming over here from Yemen that had the, you know, that explosive powder. He was a complete idiot. I mean, you see these guys, it's like the thieves that go into the liquor store and forget their weapons and don't even know why they're there, and they stand on a camera and show their faces and wonder why they get arrested when they walk out the door. It's, that's where our society is going. It's an entangling society, and that's what we're experiencing right now, and that's why we're so sensitive to all of this. And I believe, you know, on the terrorist level, with their belief systems, they're entangled in their own process, in their own religious belief. And I don't believe that I believe the Muslims are good, but I mean, there's obviously behind the Muslim religions, there are these negative things that go on.
Freddie, there are bad apples in every basket.
Exactly.
You know that.
But the bottom line, instead of contaminating the entire basket, that the bad apple's getting kicked out and then it's going to rot. That's my feeling. And we're going to see more and more of that, but you have to believe in that to make it happen even more, because it's our belief systems that come to fruition. Everything the American dream believes in today is somebody had an idea, like John Carter had an idea and he formed IBM. We have an idea and we follow those principles. And we want our freedom back. We want our Constitution back. We want everything. We want peace in this world. And I believe that's where we're going to go. But we have to constantly negate these stupid factions like we're talking about tonight, because they are going to be power crazy.
Well, this is the problem with all this.
Yeah.
Even if, I am so convinced of this, Fred, even if all terrorism happened to be eradicated,
right,
gone, I think that these secret groups would then become the terrorists just to screw us up.
Yeah, they would. I mean, if you look at the bigger group now that's trying to poison us through the foods, their preservatives and the food, everything you eat in a store is poison.
Well, are they doing that on purpose, or are they doing it for greed?
No, they're
sell
doing
us
that
junk.
They're doing it on purpose to depopulate the earth. That's my feeling.
I mean, you really think there's a group of people out there saying, let's reduce the population to 500 million. Let's kill off 6.3 billion people.
I believe that there is a group out there that has those kinds of thoughts in mind, and they've been around for a while, and they've been beat down before, and I think they're trying to make a comeback, but they're not doing too good a job at it because they're being exposed by, especially by you and your show. I mean, that's exposing a lot of stuff, having people like me on. We talk about it. Food for thought. People tell their friends tomorrow. They might not hear the show, but they're going to tell their friends.
Thanks. Single me out. Now they all know it's me.
Yes, you know? George Norrie.
Yeah,
oh, my God, George.
We're going to continue chatting, but lots of people lining up. They want to talk with you as well. Let's go to Alex in British Columbia on the wild card line. Hey, Alex, quick question. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, Fred. Hey, George. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure if you talked about SSRI medications at all, but I've heard you talk to Dr. Ann Blake Tracy in the past.
Yes.
Yeah, we talked about them a little bit, and basically we said that, you know, most of them are laced with phencyclidine and cyclohexane. And eventually, they drug your brain to the point where you're walking around in a dream state, and that's not good. And we also said that, you know, a lot of children are on these drugs, and when they go off of them is when they go into their dream state. You know, like Eric Harris, they were the king of Columbine High School, and they go out on these frenzies. So that's kind of what we discussed before.
When did this change for you, Fred? When did you, I'm going to ask you, when did you wake up?
Am I awake yet? I don't know. That's a good question. You know, that wasn't in my little question list here.
I don't go with them.
I know you don't. It's such a bad night. I love it. No,
you're probably going, he's not on the question eight. How come he's not doing eight and nine?
Yeah, I think I woke up when I developed a lot of devices at my company. You know, that little group in Chicago, that little lady and man came to me in Chicago back in 75 when I was with the National Health Federation. They said, these weird guys are putting vibrations on my apartment. I didn't believe them, but I got 20 of those in, you know, five or six different, cities lecturing with NHF over the next 10 years. And then that started my process. And that's when I started developing. I developed some devices to counteract some of this energy because I figured out how it could theoretically, being a microwave specialist anyway.
Yeah.
And so, and this, to my surprise, people said, this stuff works, you know. And I said, really? I said, I wasn't sure it was going to. It was my idea. And the stuff started working. And I think in that process, I still had my, a lot of friends in the government and still do today, and they would tell me stuff and I, you know, really wake me up. I think I really woke up with the first Iraqi war when they were going into Kuwait. I think when I found out when all those guys surrendered, all those Iraqi troops surrendered, and I found out that they were using a device made in San Diego on them to screw up their thought process, I thought that was pretty impressive. I mean, it looked like they all of a sudden they just freaked out and dropped their weapons.
Well, if we used it, why not?
Right? Yeah, and so that started getting me going more. And then when I saw the Aurora, you know, the SR-71 was flying, and Kelly Johnson, that was one of his last great achievements. And it was flying. It was not supposed to fly over Russia, but it did. And they used a Tesla beam weapon, which is a propagated wave, a conjunctive wave device, and shot off 2 feet of the wing section. And that's why they retired that plane. And so then the Aurora came out. And I saw the Aurora in Laguna Beach when I was jogging one night. And I knew a bunch of engineers because I used to work at Lockheed anyway. And so I knew a bunch of guys, and I started asking questions. And then I probably shouldn't say some of this, but then I got hooked up with the head people over at JPL. And when Kim Jong-il was launching his rockets, they remember they blow up over the pad?
Did we do that?
Yes, we did. I shouldn't tell you that, but that's it's a long story found out that one. But that's, you know, then I was awake.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Have you been following that strange spiral over Norway that they had several weeks ago? Okay.
Yeah, I have.
Richard Hoagland, and you're gonna run into him at the Conscious Life.
Yeah, I know Richard. I've known him for years. Yeah.
Richard Hoagland believes that a secret group, shadow government,
right,
had the ability to capture this Russian rocket, this missile,
right,
and captured it, literally shut it down in midair, and the spiral, of course, remnants of the fuel and everything based on how they
spin out. Yeah, the gyros go down. Yeah.
Are you convinced we have that kind of weaponry?
There's a bear poop in the woods. You bet I am. We have it. We have it big time. Big time.
Truly amazing. All right, Fred, stay with us. Already through the half wave mark here. And we'll continue to take your phone calls as well right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with Fred Bell, the Inside Track. Fred, I'm going to be with Dr. Roger Lear this Sunday as he and a group of people introduced Jordan Maxwell for a special event. And he, of course, is, I would say, the father of alien implants. You've done some work in that area, too, and you say we're not hearing too much about them anymore. How come?
Because they're obsolete now. I worked a lot in that field. They started happening probably in the late 70s, went through the early 80s, and started dying out in the 90s. And, you know, I worked with Bud Hopkins. I listened, you know, he did all the, I know he's been on your show a million
Absolutely,
times.
Absolutely, yeah.
With all the hypnotic regressions. But the bottom line was we had a program in MK Ultra, not we, but they, and I wasn't part of it, that pretty much traumatized people. It was part of the Manchurian Candidate program that Candy Jones was involved with and John Neville. I used to be on his show.
The old talk show host.
I was on his show. Art Bell used to be on his show. We were both on there. I used to talk to Candy on the phone. I didn't know she was a former Manchurian Candidate. But anyway, they developed a process of hypnosis where the person would develop, they would think they were being abducted by an alien. This would be, they used the Manchurian Candidate stuff, electroshock, all the different things to make this person have this experience. And so then the implant would be installed in the human body, and it was installed. The process is like a holographic projector. It's like, if you ever, if you're familiar with how they make integrated circuits, they have like a projector that puts an image down on what's called a mask, and the mask, of course, the mask produces it. So it's an image in a computer that actually produces something. And this would be layered onto the human brain, and it would produce circuitry that would run off the neural circuits in the brain. And then what they would do, they would activate these people would be implanted, and then they would go about their business, and they would be controlled, you know, basically going back to the early, you know, the early MK Ultra programs that they had. So then they would be controlled sometimes remotely, not much from satellite, but some satellite. So this was back when the MISTI satellite was starting to come into fruition in the mid-90s.
Well, just imagine then what they can do now.
Oh, I'll tell you what they can do now. But the bottom line was, in the case of Charles Whitman in 1982 or 84, he got up there on the school tower in Austin, Texas, and shot 14 people.
Yeah.
Okay. Then they used this to deregulate our and to get rid of certain kind of assault weapons. And they used it in many different traumatic situations. They activated these implants to cause things to happen so that we would lose our constitutional freedoms. That was the basic program there. And you can see it if you look at it from pull yourself back and look at all the incidents. I studied most of them. There's many, many. You'll see how that all started to work.
They say the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski, was part of that. Is that
yeah,
true?
I'm sure
you think
he was.
So?
Brilliant guy up in the middle of nowhere. His brother, I guess, turned him in. But, yeah, same thing. But where I was involved with that was that a lot of my clients at the time were labs, like radiology labs. And so I go to these different radiology labs, and I talk to these radiologists, and they say, yeah, we pulled this thing out of this lady. And they usually pulled it out of the back of the neck or not too much in the head because that was a difficult place or on the leg. You could put them anywhere. And they'd run pretty much a long time, you know, as long as you had a good amount of electricity in your body. And used to see the new ones that they use in the Tamiflu stuff now, the injections, they're like a little tiny, like a tiny grain of salt. That's the newest stuff because they're using nanotechnology now. You asked me where
now we're going. You're convinced that they are putting little chips in flu vaccines?
Yep. Yes, sir. I am. Not all of them, but some of them. It's new. They're having a problem getting the vaccine out there, but yes, I do believe that. I've studied nanotechnology for quite a number of years, and it's just not a problem now. We work with one atom at a time, and these things have a pretty good range, probably several hundred feet, and they can be picked up on cell phone towers and these kinds of things. They run in those frequency ranges, and so they can monitor people. It's another monitoring system. You know, I'm not paranoid about it. I'll never get a flu shot, but they're doing that now.
They're that small to fit through a needle?
Yep.
Jeez.
Look it up. Study it. It's there.
I will.
When I come to lunch, I'll bring you some information on it. How's that?
Just don't bring me an injection. That's all.
Oh, God. You've ruined the whole lunch.
Don't do that.
It's going to show you my secret.
Couple more calls here before next hour. We'll take more. Port Angeles, Washington, west of the Rockies. Tom, go ahead. You're on with Fred Bell.
Tommy. Hey, Doc. Thanks for giving me a minute.
Okay, Tommy.
I've been rereading eugenics all the way back to Galton and Darwin.
Okay.
And then doing the history all the way up to pre-war Germany, 1929, 38, and then what happened after the war.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff to that that is not reflected at all in the educational system. I certainly never got any of it. I doubt you. You might have because you're like 60. George might know more a lot about it. But there was so much still going on there. And then all that gets reflected in today's day and age is just, you know, that set of horrible circumstances that happened in Germany, right?
Yeah.
And it looks like those two generations, those two or three generations prior to the war, was a nexus for genius.
Yeah, they were.
And inventive spirit.
Yeah, they developed the different kinds of transmitters and receivers. They had the genetics to go with it. It was amazing what they did, and then it continued on into Merck and all the different companies today. They're doing more through chemistry, and then they align it with these satellites. It's amazing when you get the big picture. When I wrote my book, I presented all of that. We obviously can't cover it tonight, but I laid it all out. It's all here in this book. Yeah, it's very true, and you're right on. And that's when it really took off, was World War II. But
I just really can't help but think we might want to slide back towards that because it didn't disappear until the 70s completely, right?
No.
And we might want to push that for a while again because, you know, just being healthy, you know, being smart. I never saw it as trying to, like, embed or, you know, like to make, you know, people more intelligent and to make people better, right? It was just to try to maintain where we're supposed to be. That's what I see in the whole research that I did. Staying good.
Yeah, if we didn't have all of this ELF and all of these chemicals in the water, radiation in the water, and all this stuff, and we would be a more advanced society, and we'd be much more conscious. This stuff retards our growth, spiritual growth process.
That's part of it.
Yeah, and anyway. these guys thought they could be immune from it. That's the telling thing is the guys that did this stuff, you know, they thought they were immune from it. But they're not, and their families are part of it, and now they're starting, it goes around, comes around. It just takes a while, you know?
Thanks a bunch, Doc. George, there's lots of guys who want to get on out there. Thanks again. Have a good night, guys.
Okay, all right, thanks, Tom, for coming on, man.
Appreciate it. What also is just fantastic, Fred, is so many people are beginning to be very perceptive to this.
Yeah, that's good.
It sure is, because years ago, I don't think a lot of people would have.
No, believe me. I've you know, the first time I put a pyramid on my head, that was about 1973. I think I didn't catch it from everybody? I did. I just left it on for the spite of it at that point.
You walked around with a pyramid on your head?
Yeah, I did it for about 15 years.
You remind me of a kid I had in school, a friend of mine. He did that in class. Got two A's, by the way.
Probably got one of my pyramids.
Well, this would have been 1960s.
Oh, he was
four? 1964?
He was ahead of me, even. That would have been one of Pat Flanagan's pyramids.
He was a kid then.
Yeah,
14
smart.
Years old. Next up, we go to Phoenix. Mario, first-time caller. Go ahead, Mario.
Yes, Dr. Bell and George, pleasure having a conversation this evening with you.
Sure thing.
Great topics. I heard, I was in California, 1979, and there was a priest. Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Perfectly.
Yeah. Loud and clear.
Okay. In California, 1979, I sat in with a general, let's see, he was a three-star general, General Anderson, I believe his name was. He was retired, and he gave a seminar on cyclotronics. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah.
What he said was that he had these big, big boxes in, I believe, in Russia. That were sending out these energies to America and all over the world that actually made people irritable on the normal people. And then bipolar people went, like, in extreme directions. And I'll take my question off the air if you can more information.
That was called Project Pandora, and it started on the embassy over there. They had the American embassy in a nice beautiful building, and then they decided to move it over to this. I'm sorry, they started out in an old house, and then they moved it over to a high rise building, and there were two beams that were focused on it, and one there was 14 employees in that time that were affected by it, and one of the offices downstairs was one of the directors of the American embassy in Moscow, and he ended up, I think, committing suicide. So yeah, that's a very real. It was called Operation Pandora.
Do other countries have this kind of technology, Fred?
Oh yeah,
they
yeah.
do. Everybody's got it.
Not everybody, but England sure has. Anything we have, England has. I know Japan probably has quite a bit of it because Japan was the leader in drugs like Agent Orange and those things, because they were into population control, so they were pretty much the leaders. And then a lot of them got into biowarfare, like McMurk and all these companies got into biowarfare. So yeah, everybody's pretty much into it. I think Russia, of course, has been a huge leader in it. You know, with Pandora, you know, which is what they ended up calling it once they found what was happening. It was a 147 megahertz double beam that was being beamed on this embassy, one at the top and one at the bottom. And what happened was, I remember in the embassy, they remodeled this, and they made the Americans wait in this old beat-up house, and the Russian government says, oh, we're going to make this a really nice place for them. They moved them all in. So we went in with bugs, you know, bug detectors, and didn't find a thing because they had their beam technology.
Yeah. Don't they have technology now, too, where they can drive by your house and know exactly how many people are in there and where you are and what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of that stuff. I mean, that radar flashlight I was telling you about, cops will be carrying that. You know, there's about five or six different devices that will do that right now. Yeah, and that's used. That's used a lot.
Don't they have also the technology that, you know, in the old days, a police officer would have to get behind you, look at your license plate, you know, punch it into his computer and see if there's a warrant out for you, anything like that. Now I'm told that they have the ability to get scanners that, let's say you're on a four-lane highway.
Yeah.
The scanner will see everybody's license plate at one time, and the thug, that'll come up right away. You know,
out here where I live, I'm a good friends with the main sheriff of Riverside County.
Yeah.
They love my work. He's one of them. He's a screenwriter besides being the head cop. He comes over here. I'll just say his first name is Steve because it is. He brings his police cruiser over here. He opens it up. He's got cameras on all the lights. The new ones, you won't even see the cameras. It goes both sides, back, front, and the other sides. He's got a computer in there, and it reads all the license plates all around that car late at night at about up to 200 feet. And then it goes into a computer, which is always on, gives a complete readout, and then they get what's called false reading. So if he gets a false reading, a beeper goes off, he gets on the telephone in there, and they check it out. And they all have it out here. Everybody has. I've seen it. I've had it in my own driveway.
So they can tell, probably, at any given time, if somebody's got tickets out there, outstanding tickets or
everything,
or whatever.
Everything. As a matter of fact, in one of my cars, I let the registration run out, and one of them pulled me over, and he says, "Your registration's out." And I says, "You got to be kidding." I was driving kind of a nice car, and he says, "Yeah." I says, "How do you know?" And he says, "Well, it came up on my scanner." And then because it was right here in the town that I live in, the Riverside, you know, he said, "Well, you know," I said, "Steve Douglas was telling me all about this. Is you using the stuff that he has in his car?" And he says, "Yeah, you know Steve Douglas?" And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, okay, here's what's going to happen. You know, you get a warrant. You know, we aren't going to give you a warning, but you're going to go get this fixed, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And I went and got it registered. Oh, yeah. I've even got pulled over by it myself.
Yeah.
They knew all about me, who I was and everything when they came up. He wanted my registration, license, and insurance, but they already knew who I was.
The computer's done this to us, Fred, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, and it's quick, and it's amazing. Every time he comes over, he's got something new to show me.
He loves it.
Yeah, he does. He's a techno freak. They're all getting that way.
A friend of mine was showing me just what's going on in the world of police technology, like you've said.
Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. They have the ability to hear blocks away.
Oh, yeah.
My God.
Oh, yeah, that's another whole system of stuff. Yeah, the filters. They have a filter system. They can hear a long ways away now. That technology has been around for about 10 years.
They can pick up people whispering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not a problem. Not a problem at all. Not a problem at all.
In the old days, you had to wire somebody. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
Not anymore. No wiring. You don't need that. That's absolutely obsolete now.
Where's it all headed? Why is, you know, you've set population control, but is it also for just people control?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I mean, this kind of stuff on license plates is kind of cool because it keeps some of the bad guys off the road.
What do your plates say?
What are my plates?
Are they just numbers?
No, I have one that says Semyasi on it. Shirley MacLaine wanted that one. So I got it long.
That is the bean that you were contacted
yeah,
with.
Yeah, back.
Also, Billy Meyer was. Same one, right?
Same one, yeah, through the 70s, 80s, and that ended in 89. And I had a lot of experiences with her, lots of experiences. And then I had another friend of mine that I met through the Bilderberger family. Actually, it was the what's her name? Well, they own a good portion of Europe, and he was working out at Los Alamos, and he was working with Margaret Habsburg, her husband. Habsburgs own about 60% of Europe, and this guy was working with him. I mean, her husband was out there, and they had four grays, because you talk about in your ads on your when I hear the thing, imagine Obama showing up with some aliens.
Yeah.
Well, they had four grays working with them out there at Los Alamos on a 40-acre ranch. And he was the guy, and then there's another friend of mine, his name was James Anthony, who was working with him. Well, he was a Pleiadian, and he helped develop the laser sight years ago. And so when Margaret Habsburg's husband died, she moved to Palm Springs, and she wanted to bring some money in, but they could only allow her to bring so much in because she could mess up
the economy.
Yeah.
So we probably could use her now.
Yeah, we need her now. And so anyhow, James, he was coming over to my house in Laguna Beach when I lived over there in a NSA black truck, and he was scared to death because he was a Pleiadian. And I have a, if you ever come to my house in Laguna, I'll show you.
I'm not sure I will.
Yeah, right. I'll show you something he wrote. He wrote this thing, and it's only from a Pleiadian. He wrote this poem, and he said that he wanted to go home. And first, I didn't believe him, but whenever I knew him for a year before he left the planet, we'd go out to dinner, and he never ate. He never ate. He drank water, and it was his own water. And
what do you mean it was his own water?
I don't know where he got it from. No. He had a little bottle of water, a little clear.
Oh, that's what you meant by
yeah.
So. You had me scared there for a moment.
No, he wasn't. Yeah, and
yeah.
So he was living in a 25,000 square foot house over in overlooking in El Segundo, looking over LAX, and no furniture in the place. And all he had was one of my pyramids, one of my receptors, and one of over his bed. He says this pyramid protected him when he slept, and he was scared. And then one day he was gone. I never saw him again. So I'm assuming he was a Pleiadian because he when you get up close to him, he looked like he was about 40 years old, but he had no wrinkles, and his skin was incredibly white, and he had like blonde, like a page boy a haircut, and eyes where you could see his brain.
Nice guy?
Yeah, he was sweet and brilliant. He made me look, I mean, he probably forgot more in one day than I'll ever know.
How old do you think he was in our years?
I would have said, just guessing, I'd say 200 or 300.
My gosh.
Yeah, but I mean, this is one of my experiences that I had, and some of my friends actually did meet him and can, you know, verify that. But,
Fred, you've seen it all. Let's take some more phone calls with you when we come back. We'll take more calls next hour. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Fred, before we go to calls, I want to compliment you on the work for Inside Track. I've read a lot of these books and stories, and you go into incredible detail, and you reference it, like you mentioned, websites. But even beyond that, the appendix and the glossary of all the information that you went digging for is truly very, very well put together.
Yeah, I appreciate, you know, your compliment, and when we have lunch, I'll tell you some stuff that I really can't say on the air about some experiences that I've had that's going to blow your socks off, because I see there's a couple of areas that I can probably tune you up on, but I just can't do it on the air, and I apologize for that, because I'll get myself in trouble.
Well, I understand. Have you ever been threatened?
Well, I that's something we got to discuss.
All right.
I have, let's put it this way, I have a military surveillance.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. I'm doing some stuff that I can't talk about on the air that's for the good of this country, okay? I've sort of got back in the old niche a little bit, you know, from you know, I'm paradigm strong and everything, but I'm doing a little, few other things now. That, I guess it's just sort of in my blood, you know.
And when we talk about those who want this world order, we're talking about a group that puts themselves ahead of government, not just people here, but in other countries as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, Tavistock is... the real deal. I mean, that was started by John Dewey and another guy back in the turn of the century when the guy was very depressed, and he was a Yale graduate, and he started this the first mental institute in this country, and it ended up in England, and then they're the ones that control Rand and Stanford, out of Stanford and a lot of stuff. I mean, it's just amazing. I've got the whole, well, you've seen it in there. You know what it is. It's all in there, you know.
Okay, let's go to the phones then. Anthony in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Anthony, you're up.
Hi, George. I just want to pay you a compliment and say that you're the only host that I can listen to that can talk about things that aren't considered easy to believe, that doesn't somehow seem to come off biased against it.
Well, that's I try to present the news for you, so you can make up your own mind, Anthony. So thank you.
Yeah, I agree with Anthony on that. You do that very well.
Yeah, I just feel like that. You know, whenever I'm listening to Coast and your host, and it's a fair shot. You could see it either way. You decide yourself. That helps it, especially when you're talking about things that most people don't want to talk about or consider possible.
Okay, absolutely. That's fair enough. Well, I try to call it the way I see it, Fred.
Yeah, well, you do. I mean, you and I've been on your show many times, I feel very relaxed with you, you know, and that's because I always get nervous. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, and I get used to big crowds and lectures, but when you get on this show, this is a big show. You know, it is the big show.
Well, I tell you, Fiona Horn, the witch, and a friend of mine, she was so relaxed one night, she fell asleep. Fiona, wake up!
Yeah, that you should make a tape of that one and sell it as a tranquilizer.
Let's go to Ontario, Canada. Linda, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Thanks for holding, Linda.
Hi, George. I agree. You are great. Fred, I've got my tinfoil hat on, so that'll match your pyramid one.
Oh, good.
So aren't we a pair? My question is, I know if you're familiar with Leonard Litskillen from Coral Castle.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, he was a nobody, poor, came out of Latvia.
120 pounds.
Okay.
Little
now,
guy.
I can't believe that he's alone. Can you give some light? Don't you think he's mixed up with some enlightened group that has technology that would blow our socks off?
Well, in another book that I wrote previous to this one, I wrote about the Tibetans using an instrument called a rangoon, which is a gourd, special drums, and some other instruments, and they were able to levitate rocks up the side of a cliff to build, you know, some of their temples.
See, I think that's what Leeds Caldwin did as well at Coral Castle.
I do, too.
He said he knew the secrets of the pyramids.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. And I've never, you know, I in my studio, I've done some stuff with synthesizers and special sounds that duplicate kind of what they did. And I've had some interesting phenomenon happen here. I haven't been successful lifting rocks around, but we've made things lighter and we played with the cashmere effect and some of that stuff. So, yeah, it's not if we focus on that, it can be done. And I think part of it, of course, is directing the mind into the experiment. You know, it has to be or whatever. You know, it has to be a combination of clarity. It's focus. It takes tremendous focus. And most people with the societal burdens that we have and the environmental burdens that we have don't get that focus that they used to get. And he's down there in Florida in the middle of nowhere, and there's nobody, you know, disrupting him. And in Tibet, back when they were doing it, there was nobody around them. So I don't think they had any interference. They could focus on the job, you know.
When you were with me a couple of years ago, did you not, you played some kind of sound.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you? What was that?
Yeah, that's the sounds that I used for the levitation experiment.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a Pleiadian sound. It was taken from a tape that was done in Switzerland of a Pleiadian ship, and then it was taken apart. And then put into six or seven different linear synthesizers called Roland D50s. I still am doing that kind of work, believe it or not. I got deflected off of it because I wrote this book, which took 4 years of my life. But now I'm going back to music again. I miss it.
Linda, thanks for the call. Let's go to Athens, Ohio on the wildcard line. It's Ralph's turn. Ralph, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, on them the mind reader microwaves,
mm-hmm.
Is there any way to block those?
Now that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't want to get commercial here tonight, but we've developed devices that do block that. That's one of the things I've been very successful at. And we have a huge clientele, that you can be referenced to.
Do you wear it or screen your house with it?
No, these are devices that hang up on the wall. One of them is called a flamethrower, and it's about 2 feet by 2 feet, and it's got coils on it and different capacitors, and it's got these different traps that, you know, microwave is an easy thing to work with when you've worked with it all your life. You just have to know the frequencies of what's coming in at you and know how to block them. And then we have another device that takes ELF and blocks that. It sends it to ground, and then it sends a positive energy out to the person in the room. And we've had people that have epileptic seizures have less frequency of those. We've had children that are demented, and they start to function again. Because a lot of kids today are sensitive to these energies, and it causes, problems that are often diagnosed as mental disorders.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're really not.
Last Saturday, I went to one of my favorite L.A. night spots, and I'm not going to mention the name. The place will be packed.
Yeah.
But maybe I should one day, and we should have a party there.
Yeah.
But anyways, I'm sitting down watching the band play, and a guy from Eastern Europe is a friend with some people at the table. He sits down with us. He pulls out a little device, Fred. It had three little antennas sticking out of it. A little black thing is about 4 inches long.
Right.
Puts it down, and I had my cell phone on the table. And he went, "I can disable your phone." And I went, "Excuse me?"
Yeah.
And he says, I can make it where your phone doesn't work. And I went, "Come on, show me." He takes this little device, turns it on, and it kind of like aims it toward my cell phone, right?
Right.
I swear to God, I picked up the phone and the signal was gone.
Yeah, yeah, I can relate to that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that. That's a form of jammer. You know, we call those jammers.
Yeah.
And it runs on a frequency similar to cell phones, and it's probably a wide spectrum, so he got all the...
He wiped everybody out.
Yeah, he wiped everybody. I was going to say, he probably wiped everybody out, yeah. Yeah, you can do that. And with the technology today, these very high-power transistors that run... Well, look at the lasers. When we started doing lasers, you know, to have a half-a-watt laser, you had to have something the size of a truck to keep it cool. And now you can go on eBay and buy a half-a-watt laser that probably runs on 100 watts of electricity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's go to Daniel in Huntsville, Alabama. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hey, it's great talking to you guys tonight.
Great. Good to have you.
Being where I'm at, besides NASA being out here, there's a Redstone Arsenal, and they do a lot of interesting things out here, and I've been seeing UFOs my whole life. That aside, I moved into a particular apartment building, and this is where this talking to you really comes in. While in that building, laying on the couch, I thought I was having out-of-body experiences, Then one night it got way out of control. I ended up in the hospital. And essentially I felt that I went way into the future. I can see it. It's like an utterly profound movie. And as soon as I could actually hear electronic devices in that apartment when I got back. When I got back, everything electronic didn't work, including my cable. I had to replace the box and everything. Also, I must note that I could hear voices coming from the, like, as if a transducer. It had been turned into a transducer, the remote control unit of my cable TV unit. And I could hear distinct personalities, two males and a female.
Huh.
You know, it was kind of squawky, you know, because it wasn't an actual good fidelity speaker. But is that fit in with this at all? Because it has really freaked me out, and I just want to move out of here.
Should he move, Fred?
Yeah, I probably would move out. That devices like that are called stemoceivers, and they were originally developed by Jose Delgado, but they were funded by the Naval Research Facility. But yeah, those they monitor your EEG, your electroencephalograph waves, and then they send them into separate radio channels and feed them back into your head. They'll take two beams, two radio frequency beams, and they shoot them into two different parts of your head, and then they do an audio signal in between. So what happens is you'll hear the audio signal in between, which will be like voices and things. And some people that have had your experience, and I've talked to some of them, have actually heard background sounds in a control room where this is going on, so that the people that are doing that actually have some background chatter of their own environment that comes through in this projection. So you might have been targeted for something, or you might be an experiment, because this kind of stuff is going to be part of what's been out, you know, called Operation Moonbeam, where, you know, the higher level of it is where you don't hear any voices. All of a sudden, you actually think you're having a religious experience, like Jesus is talking to you, or ETs are talking to you, or God is talking to you. That's the higher level of your experiencing and explain the lower form of that. But the original device was called a stemoceiver.
Okay, very good. Santa Rosa now,
yeah.
West of the Rockies. Wesley's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Wesley.
Hi. Dr. Bell,
yeah.
Did you ever get the chance to meet Buckminster Fuller?
I actually did.
Right.
Yeah, I did. I was doing a lecture at Amherst College, and I was back there. I did the radio show, and this is back like about 79. I was back there. A guy named Alan Goldman, who started these Conscious Life Expos originally, one of the founders of it, took me there. And I gave a lecture on the carbon atom. And I presented it as an octahedron, and Bucky Fuller had presented it as a tetrahedron. And all of a sudden, the first day of giving lectures back there, it got kind of quiet, and everybody ran to Bucky and said, "This isn't what you were teaching us about the carbon atom, because you know it's your basic thing in your body is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen is what makes the body up, the four elements." And so Buck Fuller says, "You know, I was thinking that possibly that Dr. Bell is right." Now, this is before nanotechnology got really going. He says, "Dr. Bell could be right." Actually, it was Fred Bell in those days. I didn't have my PhD yet. So he said, "Fred Bell's probably right." And the next day I had this tremendous presence, because Bucky had come and blessed me, and then they offered me a $47,000 grant to go back and work in their physics. That's a true story.
That's great. I believe you.
Yeah, and what happened was I said, it was a great honor to have that. I mean, Amherst is a great school. It's pre-med for Harvard and everything. And I said, "This is a great offer, but I lived in Ann Arbor, which is a little bit south of here, and I used to shovel snow. And I'm out in California now, and I have a phobia to shoveling snow." That's how I sort of made a light joke out of it, and so I didn't take the grant. But, yeah, I definitely had a run-in with him, and he was fabulous.
Fantastic. Yeah. I picked up his book, Synergetic Geometry, and been trying to study that on my own. And when I was in kindergarten, that's when Congress passed the separation of church and state.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when I was in kindergarten, we pledged allegiance, or we prayed to God, you know. And then the next year, when I came back to first grade, we were taught evolution. So I thought, right there, something's not right. And they're teaching us what they want us to learn, not how to learn.
Yeah.
So I had problems learning in school. And later on, I just started studying on my own. And I think there's so many patterns that are going on. And when we impeached Nixon, we got Rockefeller as a vice president out of that.
Yeah.
And that's when we probably got a lot of this corporate banking situation in.
Yeah.
Good point. All right. Thank you, Wesley.
Yeah.
Good insight. Good insight.
Oh, yeah. Very good. I mean, a lot of us, I mean, I hated the school system. I got out on my own. That's how I ended up at the University of Michigan at night, studying at night classes over as a kid.
Still a Wolverine fan?
Yeah. I lived on Division Avenue, 739 North Division, and right next door is a vacant lot, or a big lot, where the football team always practiced.
My niece is going there now.
Oh, really?
She loves it.
Oh, it's a great town, except they put that horrible parking lot over the downtown part and ruined it.
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, you'll cry when you see it. That's such a quaint town. I love that town. I was born there. And
boy, they used to have a great football team for college.
Oh, yeah. The U of M versus the Buckeyes.
Oh, every year.
Every year. I was there in the stadium.
It's a classic. 80,000, right? Or 100?
I don't remember. It's at least 80,000.
I think it's 105,000.
It was always full.
Yeah.
And it was cold, but nobody cared.
Nobody cared. San Francisco we go. Zurb, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Zurb.
Hey, how's it going, you guys?
Good, sir.
Good. I once read a book, I think it was Mark Twain. He wrote What is Man? And he talked about building a machine out of rock. And was it possible for the machine to run like an engine, so to speak? And the engine could actually run, if you thought about it. It just wouldn't last very long. I was just wondering if you're the person that you have on as a guest tonight, I forget his name, but
Fred Bell.
Fred Bell. Is it possible that the pyramids were made with engines made of rock?
Well, my opinion on that is that they had a technology similar to a laser, because in the quarries over there near the pyramids, they're actual blocks that are not fully cut. They're partially cut. And it suggests some type of a laser type weapon. Not weapon, but cutting
yeah,
tool.
It's a fine cut, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. That's my feeling on that.
They're off by just hundreds of an inch.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what do we use lasers for today? To do surveys and build houses and stuff, and that's what we use. I mean, they're very accurate.
I was putting in some molding last year in my house.
Yeah.
And it was down in the basement. And, you know, you get the miter saw and all that, and you've got modern technology, right? Should be perfect.
Right.
I always end up having to put putty in my seams to make it look like they connected.
Well, that you're not the only one.
Not
in my house.
Good.
Yeah, in my house in Laguna, it was built so flimsy that when I just put up, you know, 4x8 panels in one of the rooms, and I got up to the corner where the walls meet the ceiling, and it's off by half an inch, and that's the way they built the house.
Yet those Egyptians, or whoever made those,
yeah,
they were perfect.
Yeah, absolutely perfect. And it's even today totally perfect, you know. Not all of the pyramids were built that well, but most of them were, you know.
Yeah, well, that's true. How do you get the inside track, the book?
Oh, you call a couple of phone numbers, 1-800-729-2603.
You better give that again.
Yeah, 1-800-729-2603 or 949-499-2603, or just type in Dr. Fred Bell on the search engine and some of my phone numbers will come up, or as tonight on your website.
Can you order it right off your website?
You sure can, yeah.
Okay, that's always easy. That seems to be a growing business these days, Fred.
Yeah, we are. It is. Our website, I apologize, it's not the most perfect website. We've been trying to update it, but I lost 4 years of my life writing this book and some of the other things I've been doing. And so I'll turn my attention to the website. But it does work. It's functioning. Our site is secure.
Let's come back and take final phone calls with Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Fred, I don't want to leave people helpless here. What can they do to protect themselves, fight back?
Well, obviously, avoid the chemical foods as much as possible. For example, the Tamiflu works with a vector that has been dropped off in chemtrails, so the two come together in your body and they create a genetic transformation of your body and your immune system. So, you know, excellent, you know, food, you know, as much as stay off the red meat because it's full of, you know, hormones and stuff, that kind of stuff. Secondly, a good nutritional program is highly advised. In my book, I have that question answered in my book, by the way, the nutritional program that I recommend, especially for depression, because one of the big things that all these programs do is create depression, and that's how Big Pharma makes their money, treating depression, you know, covering it up. So I have a nutritional program. We make a lot of products ourselves. They're anti-ELF products that we've been making for over 34 years. They're available to people. We recommend, we have a device that we don't make that's called the Nucalert that we sell. It comes out of Texas. After 9/11, the government bought about 300,000 of these. You put it in your pocket. If you're around radiation, like you're in a building and somebody dumps some ground up radioactive particles, which you'd never see in a building, you don't get, you know, you don't die a week later from that.
Right.
So we've got a lot of stuff like that. It's just too much to really go over.
I understand.
And I just want to say to your people out there, we're set up with Verizon. We'll everybody that calls in will a person will call them back, but it might take a few days. We will take care of everybody 100%.
Very good. Back to the phones we go. Petaluma, California. It's Greg's turn. Hey, Greg, you're up.
Hey, thanks for having me on tonight.
Sure.
I really appreciate the ultra fascinating conversation tonight. It's really off the charts. Just from personal experience, I think for a lot of folks, if it's something that hits home to them, it makes it more real. And for example, chemtrails are something that everybody all over the place can actually identify with and see. All they have to do is look up and realize
sure.
that there's a contrail going from horizon to horizon, and it's just hanging there. And so it makes it more tangible. And I want to know about the connection between the barium salts and the scalar web technology that seems to be sort of developing, every day. Any comments on that?
What do you think is going on with the chemtrails, Fred?
Well, the chemtrails, they started out with bromide. They basically, after the bromide, they started putting in DNA samples from disease conditions like bacteria, mold, anything they can shove through those engines, and they've got it down to a pretty good science now. So they're full of all kinds of things that make you sick. That's the best way to describe it. And they're not here to reverse the heating of the planet, you know, to darken the atmosphere. They're not here for that at all. They're primarily here for vectoring with other things that are going to go on, because they go in through the respiratory system. You breathe them in, and there's lots of new things coming down the pike that are going to go with the chemtrails that aren't even out. The Tamiflu vaccine is just part of what that's about. I do cover this a little bit more in the book, and I know you have some fabulous shows on chemtrails too, probably in your archives. There's a lot of information.
Sometimes I think they're trying to dumb us down with the chemtrails.
Well, yeah, that's in a nutshell, exactly. Hello, that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then wipe out our immune system, so that's our consciousness.
Aspartame, stay away.
Oh, yeah.
MSG, stay away.
Yep.
Fluoride, what do we do about that?
Fluoride is a slow-growing cancer. You know, the best way to combat fluoride is to keep your pH way in the alkaline range, and it won't hurt you. If you're anywhere near acid, it could cause a lot of cancer. Same thing with water. I mean, water is slightly radioactive because we dropped over 900 bombs over the years. And which hit all the water supplies of the world. Unless it's very deep water coming from certain artesian wells, it's okay. So, and that causes breast cancer and prostate cancer. So there's a lot of things by keeping your pH balance together that you can fight this off. Because cancer is one of the biggies. Depression, cancer, those are the kinds of things. Alzheimer's disease will be speeding up more, because that's going to be a threat to the Social Security system if we live too long. And now that we're living longer, that shows up. So they're working on bringing that on at an earlier age. It's all this stuff. It's just the plethora of things that are going on out there, and it's being orchestrated, you know, obviously by the one world
order. Social Security. Do we still have that?
sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, I mean.
Well, you're almost age where you can start taking it, right?
Yeah, I'm 66.
Yeah, you can take it and work, right?
Yeah, you can take it and work. You know, that's not a problem. But I'm in really good shape, I think. You know, I'm in pretty good shape. I don't feel any different than when I probably did this first show with you guys, you know, 10, 12 years ago.
Was there a time you were out of shape?
Yeah. Are you kidding? That comes and goes. I'm probably out of shape now to what I used to be. I haven't when I moved down here to where I'm at now, I lifted a safe and I got a hernia, so I need a little bit of a hernia.
Oh, you lifted a safe?
Yeah, I was in great shape. I was lifting. I got a small
hernia,
so I got to get an operation. I'm human, you know. So that slowed me down big time. I can't exercise. As soon as I get that fixed, I'll be back. I was a runner all my life and all that kind of stuff.
What was in the safe?
Nothing. Unfortunately, if it was full of gold or something, I could, it was empty. I was just moving it, you know.
Let's go to Lady in Kanik, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hi, Lady.
Hey there, George. This is Lady of Kanik, Alaska.
There you are.
Yes, sir. Long time. I'm really happy with the guest you got on tonight. Maybe he can answer this question
all
for
right.
me. Sir, last year, this same time of year, I was given shelter to a lady that was homeless at the time. And in my far room of my house, which faces the northwest, up here in Alaska, you can see the sky and the stars are like diamond. And there's some kind of stars that don't really look like stars. And I was talking to her, and it was like moving. And I said, hey, look at this. And I went and I opened up the back door because she was like laying on this bed and she got a straight view to look up at what I was pointing at. And when I opened that back door, this beam of light came from this point of light and it came through my back door and it lit up my whole room and it was gold. It was like as if you take like high power lines and stick them together, the sparks. And we were, like, giggling for, like, an hour and a half later. Can you please tell me what that was?
George's probably as good at that as I am, but that would we would classify that, I would anyway, as a UFO. And the light could have been, you know, some of them actually don't hurt you. They actually have a healing property because their propulsion systems are geared that way, whereas other ones, people get near them and they get radiation burns. So if you're laughing, I would say that was a friendly UFO. Yeah.
Which happens.
Yeah, yeah, which does happen, believe it or not. I mean, you hear all the negative stuff, but believe me, for every bit of negative, there's two positives. It's the way it is now.
Quantum biology, what the heck is it? What does it mean?
Oh, now you're going to hit me with the good stuff. Quantum biology is where we go into, well, first of all, we look at the meridian system. The meridian system has microtubules in it. These microtubules move a small plasma, and this is like the acupuncture meridian. Quantum biology looks at the cell in that structure as a conduit, but it's an instantaneous conduit. We used to look at cells as reproducing through mitosis, and a cell we look at as an electrical structure that would through osmosis feed one part of the structure would feed another. Now we're seeing through a holographic process that the cell is instantaneously affected by the energy that actually makes it grow. And an example of that would be a school of fish. There's 500 fish and they all turn, boom, or 500 birds in the sky and they just make a turn all in synchronicity. That same energy works our cells in our body and it has an intelligence. And by keeping that intelligence alive through the immune system, you can have a much healthier cell system. I'm working on a device called QBAM, which is Quantum Biological Adjustment Machine. It's something that I'm working on now. It's not available for sale or anything, but we're building one of these things. We'll actually go in and make changes in your body instantaneously. It will also analyze by using quantum, you know, it's like some people say, oh, quantum is teleportation. Well, yeah, we use that because when you work in the quantum field, there's no such thing as time.
What kind of changes are you going to make in the body?
Oh, well, first of all, if you take a small child and he gets his fingernail cut off below the last joint and you don't try to sew it back on, it grows back naturally, okay? That kind of stuff. You can grow it back. It will grow back naturally. Using that technology, we have several different processes that will go inside the body and actually make bones regrow and other parts of the body. There's a thing that's called quantum or phantom DNA. They took a chamber recently, put some DNA in it, and read it out on a scope, you know, on a screen, on a computer screen. Then they took the DNA out of the chamber, and it stayed on the screen, even though it wasn't there anymore, because of quantum entanglement. So we're dealing with quantum tunneling and quantum entanglement. There's a lot of devices like the SQUID device that was developed at IBM up north. that work on some of these principles, but we're pretty much, I'm going to be doing a workshop on this, by the way, at the Conscious Life Expo. Forgot to mention that. And I'm going to really go in great detail into quantum biology. And it's in the last chapter of my book, by the way.
All right. Have you ever been to Murfreesboro, Tennessee?
You know, it sounds familiar.
Well, you're going right now with Chris.
Okay.
Coast to coast. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. All right, guys. Great show tonight.
Thanks.
Just wanted to ask, I'm in the military and have had every single injection known to man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I was wondering, you mentioned earlier that they had, nanotechnology they could put into the injections. What do you think that, how that would affect, you know, military personnel or just people in general? Yeah, I don't know if the military is getting that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were. It's not every injection with the Tamiflu that this is happening. It's happening in more and more because it's still experimental, but it is happening. What they're doing in the military, I don't know. I'd have to talk to somebody there. But I would just, having been in the military myself and having seen the Gulf War syndrome and having seen all these things that happen and all the things that happen in Iraq, that people come back, having seen microbacterial infections. There's only one hospital in this country. It's in Huntington Beach, California. They can treat those that only seem to be in military people. It's quite possible. I'm not trying to scare you, but it's quite possible.
Any reaction, Chris, to all these vaccines you took?
None that I can notice.
No.
But, yeah, I'm still young right now, so you never know.
Yeah, you got to watch it. I had my share of vaccines earlier in my life, Fred, both as a kid and then in the military. And, you know, I'm not sure I would take them anymore.
Yeah, well,
not those.
We developed a process called Pirlo, which is an electrolyte that was developed from World War II when we found people that were exposed to radiation in great amounts, it didn't hurt them. There were others that didn't have electrolytes in their brains, their bodies. They got hurt at great distances. And we have a product called Pirlo that people take that probably to a point will dissolve these types of implants, because it is an implant and it is destructible by raising the electrolytes in your body. The implants run on electricity off the neural circuits, but it's like they have a voltage regulator in them. If you exceed the voltage, you're going to short circuit the voltage regulator, and that's what we try to do by supercharging people with trace minerals and electrolytes. That's one of the areas of the chemistry that I'm working in right now.
All right, let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, east of the Rockies. Tiffany, we have you. Hey, Tiffany.
Hi, Mr. Noy. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
Great. I had a question for Dr. Bell. I'm an Air Force brat, and my brother is actually a physicist. And I was wondering if you had done any research on a tetrahedron. I know that you are interested in pyramids and wondered if you'd done any research with that shape.
Yeah, I do about 40 years of research with it. It's tetrahedron, yeah. And I've done a lot of research. The shape energy, what happens is whenever you take... some form of matter and it occupies space and time, it has an energy field. The tetrahedron is used in the red blood cell to deliver oxygen and pull carbon monoxide dioxide out of the body. All these shapes are used in the body, and that's why our bodies function the way they do on one level. So yeah, I've done a tremendous amount of research. I wrote a book on it called Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light, if you want to order it.
What have you heard, Fred, about the false flag, the phony presentation of a UFO encounter? Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier with that general that what's his name that was out at Area 51. That's a big program on the Operation Blue Beam. Have you done
Blue Beam? Yeah,
you've done that one.
We've talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's in that technology, which is holographic projectors, which goes back into the MISTI satellite series that evolved out of the 90s into the present times where we are now.
Jerry in Alabama, it's your turn. Go ahead, Jerry.
In 1959, I was on Anahuac Atoll, and I got up real early in the morning to go down to Motapu because I had a shortwave radio to listen to Ingemar Johansson and Floyd Patterson fight.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I went down in my office. I had a big window, you know, you lift up, no glass in it, with a big desk backed up to it, and I was sitting there. It was just about the lower daylight coming on, and something come by that window, about, I'd say, 70 knots, about 40 to 60 feet in there. It was shaped like a 45 bullet. Now, but it was about the size of a mid-sized Winnebago. It made no noise, and I didn't see any kind of stabilizer on this thing. It did have like a tail low attitude on it. and it just come by the window there. And this is out from north to south. Now, this is a little island out in the Pacific. There ain't nothing north of there for 1,000 miles. I don't know what that thing was. Was there any, it was mahogany in color, but was there any kind of activity that you know of, or have you read about in 59 out in that area?
We had a Delta bomber that was a plutonium-powered ship. One crashed up in Archuleta Mesa, and that was a big cover-up that had a bullet-like shape. Other than that, I wouldn't know. It would be, i.e., now a UFO. This was probably a joint alien thing, and this thing was about 60 feet long and probably 20 feet in diameter. You know, that it was bullet-shaped, and it was a Delta, but it had little stubby wings on it, little tiny stubby wings on it. I remember that much, and that's about all I know.
Absolutely. It's a long time ago, too. My gosh.
Yeah, what's his name? Investigated that back in the 80s. I forget. Remember that case very well when that thing crashed, and they had these all kinds of military coverage. I was hanging out with the people at Dulce. We were up there ultrasounding the ground in Archuleta Mesa and doing all kinds of research on that alien installation up there. That was another story, another day.
Ironically, the former heavyweight champion Ingemar Johansson died 1 year ago on January 30th, 2009.
Wow.
Small world. Fred, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Fred Bell, The Inside Track. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.